From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start today with our monthly tour of recent science headlines. Joining me on the line from the London headquarters of the journal Nature is Chief Digital Editor Anna Nagel. Anna, good to talk with you again.
Good to be here.
Let's start with the most recent story on our list. Researchers announced this past week that a person known as the Berlin patient was cured of HIV after a blood transfusion. How did this work?
So the Berlin patient was actually a decade or so ago, but the latest one this week is the London patient. So yes, he is the second person with HIV who appears to have been clear of the virus after receiving a stem cell transplant.
And why did he need that stem cell transplant, or was the goal of this specifically to clear HIV?
So the one thing that the two patients have in common, the Berlin patient and the London patient, is that they both had a form of blood cancer that was resistant to chemotherapy, and so both needed a bone marrow transplant, which had the useful side effect of also being able to clear them of HIV because of a certain mutation that the donors both had.
And the donors were both resistant to HIV.
Yeah, so a very small number of people have two copies of a mutation in a certain gene that makes them resistant to HIV infection. It affects the receptors on the surface of white blood cells and basically prevents the virus from binding to them. So when the physicians were looking for a suitable bone marrow donor for the London patient, they also looked to see if that donor happened to have two copies of this mutation, and they found a donor that ticked the boxes.
You know, that's kind of interesting because when we think about the word resistant, we tend to think of that as kind of a passive thing, right? That if you didn't have the infection yet, you would be resistant to it, but not necessarily the idea that it would clear out an active infection. Was that a surprise to researchers?
So that's part of what happened because of the bone marrow transplant. So that the idea behind that transplant was that it would basically destroy their infected white blood cells and replace them with healthy stem cells from the donor. And that appears to be what happened. And it also had the side effect that it basically replaced their blood in a way that cleared out the virus.
Is this something that could become a treatment for HIV? I mean, this is two cases a decade apart. Obviously, researchers didn't jump on the first case and develop it as a treatment. It's worked twice. Is this just going to continue to be kind of an oddball rare case, or is this something that could become more?
So I guess there's a couple of things to note there. One is that it does show that that Timothy Ray Brown, who was the Berlin patient, wasn't a one-off. So there is some potential with this treatment. The other thing to note is that it wouldn't really be suitable for most people with HIV. A bone marrow transplant is a very serious procedure, and it has far greater risk than taking the very effective HIV meds that people generally take just every day. But if the patient also happens to have leukemia or needs a transplant, then it might be logical to find a donor who has those mutations that I mentioned earlier that could also help deal with the HIV. There are 40 or so other patients who have had similar treatments from donors like these two. But they're not so far down the line yet. They're being tracked by doctors all over the world, and no doubt we'll hear more about their progress in due course. But with this London patient, it's been a good 3 or so years since he had that transplant, so the doctors and the researchers are leaving it a good amount of time before they're reporting back on how effective these treatments have been.
I'm talking with Anna Nagel. She's chief digital editor at the journal Nature. On a rather different note, researchers have modified brewer's yeast, the yeast we use for bread and beer and also a lot of research, to produce THC and also CBD, the active ingredients in marijuana. What are they hoping to do with this?
So what these researchers have done is they've basically turned a sugar that's usually found in yeast called galactose into the THC and CBD. And one of the benefits of creating these synthetic routes to producing natural products is that you have a more reliable method and process for producing these compounds.
And are they thinking that this would be like a commercial way of producing these for biomedical purposes?
So right now, the kind of yields that they've managed to produce from this process, which involve tweaking a bunch of genes from five different types of bacteria, the cannabis plants. They made 16 genetic tweaks to be able to transform that sugar into those cannabinoids. But the idea that they'll be able to produce it at significant quantities is a little way away for now. The research that they've reported, they produced about 8 milligrams of THC per litre, and even less for CBD. And it really needs to be maybe 100 times that to be a viable production route.
Of course, the other question and potential use here is if these yeast are being used to produce something like beer or wine, could they be used to produce beer or wine that also contain THC or CBD?
So that's not something that these researchers looked at, but there is active research in all kinds of areas. So there are some researchers, I think, in Canada that are looking to produce water-soluble cannabinoids for the beverage industry, but that's not what this particular team were looking at.
All right. Well, another interesting case of transformation, researchers have given mice night vision using nanoparticles. How does that work?
Exactly. We now have super mice who can see at a wavelength that we're not able to. So mice and humans can't see in infrared, which has wavelengths that are slightly longer than red light, but though we do feel it is heat. So what these scientists did was to create nanoparticles that convert those infrared wavelengths into visible light. So in this case, they absorb the infrared and then they emit it at slightly shorter wavelengths, in this case, green light. And then they injected those nanoparticles into the eyes of mice.
Hmm. Okay, I'm not really good with eyes. I have to say that kind of...
No, me neither.
The idea of injecting things into eyes, but the idea of being able to see heat, you know, without big night vision goggles is obviously very attractive for a number of reasons. Is this a permanent? Do these nanoparticles stick around permanently once injected, or is this a transient effect?
So from what they've done with the mice, they've tested it that it seemed to work. The photoreceptors in the mice, in the eyes of the mice, did respond to the infrared light and produced electrical signals, activated the visual processing areas of the brain. They did a couple of tests and it seemed to work. Of course, there are some, I suppose, possible applications in terms of military and security, but there are a couple of things that would prevent us putting this straight into humans. One of them being that the nanoparticles, as they've currently been produced, contain heavy metals, which are unlikely to be approved for use in humans. The team is actually developing organic versions to get around that. But one other potential thing to think about is that the human visual system has developed over millions of years. We've evolved to a certain point. So it's kind of difficult to know how we'd respond to suddenly being able to see in infrared. It's definitely not something that I would be keen to experiment with. there's also the potential that the same kind of mechanisms could be used or adapted to deliver drugs via this kind of mechanism as well.
Does having these nanoparticles injected, do they know, affect their normal vision, their ability to see red light? Or does it block that in some way? Or does it just augment their vision?
I think it just augments it. They did. They compared how ordinary mice behaved alongside the modified mice with a couple of trials in light and dark, and it didn't seem to affect those other things, I think, but they were focusing mainly on their ability to recognize the infrared light.
Well, as always with great science, lots of fun ideas that we will have to see where they actually go. Anna Nagel is the chief digital editor for the journal Nature. Thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. At least half of all women in science have experienced sexual harassment. In fact, rates of sexual harassment in academia are second only to the military. So when the Me Too movement launched, women in science jumped right in and created their own hashtag, MeTooSTEM. STEM, of course, being the acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. Now, an outspoken Me Too STEM leader is in danger of losing her research job at Vanderbilt University, for reasons that are not entirely clear, but many see as an example of the way women are punished for speaking out. Meredith Wadman has been following this story for the journal Science, and she joins me now. Meredith, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
The person at the center of this story is Bethann McLaughlin, a Vanderbilt University professor. Tell us a little bit about her, who she is.
She is really larger than life. She's actually born in Boston and later, quite soon after that, located to St. Louis with her family, but has been at Vanderbilt now for many years. She got her PhD in neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania and then did a postdoc in Pittsburgh and then moved to Vanderbilt in 2002. And she's been a tenure-track neuroscientist there since 2005. She's now 51 years old, and she is as activist as any 22-year-old you ever met. She is really out there.
Well, she, this past fall, shared the second annual Disobedience Award from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab, an award for nonviolent civil disobedience for her role in the Me Too STEM movement. She's been really instrumental in putting pressure on the National Institutes of Health, in particular, to create and enforce policies that would hold people accused and found guilty of sexual harassment accountable, make them potentially ineligible for research funding. And in fact, as this whole story that we're going to get to of her potentially losing her job has been coming to light, you know, the director of the NIH has publicly thanked her for pushing the NIH and for pushing this agenda over the past year and a half. I mean, she's made really valuable contributions as an activist.
That's right. She's really gotten the attention of some big players in medical research, not least Frances Collins, who tweeted, as director of the NIH in late February, a special thank you to Mikkel Neuro, that's her Twitter handle, whose leadership with Me Too STEM has given a voice to victims of harassment. And that came on the heels of NIH publicly apologizing for its lack of action on sexual harassment to sort of let there be consequences for men, usually, sometimes women, who receive its funding, who then are found by their institutions to have sexually harassed.
But of course, when you say she's as activist as any 22-year-old, Beth Ann McLaughlin can be a little bit brash and sometimes rubs some people the wrong way, right?
Oh, yes. Her tweets are really take-no-prisoners tweets a lot of the time. She's not one for diplomacy. She does not seem to have an inner editor ever. And so if you're on the receiving end, it can be pretty harsh. But she definitely calls the truth as she sees it.
Well, Meredith Wadman, you reported almost a month ago now that Beth Ann McLaughlin was in danger of losing her job at Vanderbilt University, as we mentioned, a neuroscience researcher and professor, tenure-track researcher there. The reasons for that are complicated, and we'll get to that full story. But what do we actually know at this point about her employment status at Vanderbilt University?
Well, as of right now, she stands to lose her job at the end of this month, absent an intervention from the chancellor, the very top guy at Vanderbilt. Last month, a faculty committee that had been considering her appeal of her tenure denial came down on the side of the university and said, no, this tenure denial was justified. The only person that can overrule that committee is the chancellor. And there's a petition out there with more than 10,000 signatures now urging him to do just that.
Let's take a step back. What does it mean for someone to have their tenure denied? I mean, tenure gives you essentially job security going forward. But if your tenure is denied, is that the same as being fired?
In effect, Vanderbilt and other universities have been known to allow a person, once they are denied tenure, a year to sort of get their house in order and find another job before being shown the door. So it's not necessarily immediate, but in essence, it means that you're out of a job at the place you've been denied tenure, and that's going to be really tough going forward to find another place that will grant you tenure, or at least to find one of equal prestige to somewhere like Vanderbilt.
Well, Meredith Wadman, because Beth Ann McLaughlin has become known, really gained a degree of celebrity for her Me Too STEM work, I think a lot of people have assumed that that's what is behind this tenure denial. But you've reported that it's not that simple and it goes back several years. So can you fill us in on how we got to this point?
Yes. In the summer of 2014, Beth Ann McLaughlin and a colleague visiting from the University of Washington, a scientist named Dana Miller, were invited to the home of a colleague of McLaughlin's at Vanderbilt, now at University of Alabama, Birmingham, a man named Aurelio Galli, who was also a neuroscientist. He had recently been sued by a former graduate student of his for sexual harassment. It had happened just a couple of weeks before this dinner party at his home. And Miller and McLaughlin both say they witnessed that, A, he was wearing a gun and noted that he had a permit to carry it outside his home, and then proceeded to basically say, I'm going to destroy this student, I'm going to ruin her, I'm going to spend every penny to make sure her life is miserable. Now, this is what they say he said, and he has not commented, would not comment to me for the article in Science that ran on February 15th. However, that lawsuit was dismissed in December of 2014. The woman who'd sued him reached a settlement with Vanderbilt University. The terms of that are undisclosed. Soon after that, Miller, the visiting University of Washington scientist, decided that she needed to file a complaint with Vanderbilt. They had sort of assumed, I think, McLaughlin and Miller, that the lawsuit would look after Dr. Galli getting what they thought would be his just desserts. And when that settled out of court, they felt they needed to notify the university and that he should be investigated. That's my understanding as they have relayed this to me. Soon thereafter, Bethann McLaughlin in March 2015 offered testimony telling Vanderbilt what she had seen, telling investigators there the events of the dinner party. And at that time, Galli went to Vanderbilt investigators and said, well, guess what? Bethann McLaughlin has been sending these nasty anonymous tweets about Vanderbilt colleagues. There were tweets sent. They were from an anonymous multi-user account. They did not name Vanderbilt people or Vanderbilt, with one exception, an exception in which Bethann McLaughlin complained that Galli was getting an awful lot of NIH money but was chronically complaining about not having enough money. So that was as bad as it got in terms of anyone being named. But the bottom line is the Vanderbilt investigators then, in Bethann's estimation, turned the tables on her and began investigating her for these anonymous tweets or alleged anonymous tweets. And at that time, a disciplinary probe of her was launched, and she basically had her tenure process frozen for 17 months. The disciplinary probe was conducted by a 3-member faculty committee. They eventually split 2-1 in her favor. No discipline was ever imposed. And she came out of that, and the tenure process restarted. And then it got more complicated. Do you want me to keep going?
I mean, this is a really complicated story. There's, you know, the first allegation of sexual harassment by a student against a Vanderbilt faculty member, a colleague of McLaughlin's, and she's involved in testifying against that colleague. Then there's this kind of counter-disciplinary thing where they say, okay, but you know, you, McLaughlin, were actually acting out of turn with these tweets that were not respectful to your colleagues.
None of which were ever proven, by the way.
Right. And meantime, she's trying to advance her career. They froze her tenure process, and then it resumed. And what happened?
Well, what happened was when the process resumed, a 9-member committee that's like the last stop before you get tenure approved her tenure. And then the dean of medicine intervened and said, committee, I think you should be aware of this disciplinary probe that just happened and that you should revote, but have a look at the findings of this disciplinary probe first, please. And after that, what had been a positive vote on her tenure by this 9-member committee became a unanimously negative vote. And so she was denied tenure in the fall of 2017. Now, it should be noted that the earlier vote, the first positive one, was not unanimous. It was split. It was like 5 in favor on a 9-member committee. So it wasn't a total slam dunk, but it was, you know, an approval of her tenure, which was then reversed after the dean of medicine intervened. So, yeah, it's complicated. It also should be noted that the decision to deny her tenure in the fall of 2017, which she immediately appealed, but that was a long process that's only just concluding now, that predated her Me Too activism on a very public stage in the country at large. She really emerged on that stage in the spring of 2018. Not to say that she wasn't counseling women at Vanderbilt and supporting them and so on for years before, but she didn't become famous, in quotes, in the world of Me Too until beginning about 9 months ago.
So this would not seem to be, you know, the dates don't match up for this to be related to her Me Too STEM activism specifically, but it has been seen by some as an example of the ways in which women who are advocates, who are outspoken activists on this issue, suffer repercussions. And in fact, seems rather prescient. Anita Hill, actually, you've reported, emailed her last summer to thank her for speaking out and also kind of to warn her that, you know, there would be consequences for her and for her career.
Absolutely. And that tweet is pinned at the top of her Twitter feed for anyone who's interested in seeing it. Yes, Anita Hill has been a supporter of hers.
So what has the response been as it has become known publicly? Obviously, the tenure decision, as you're saying, goes back to 2017. But this is really just kind of hitting public knowledge in the past month or so as this deadline for whether or not she will have a job continuing at Vanderbilt has been approaching. What's the public response and the response on the Vanderbilt campus been?
I think it's been strong. There's a, as I mentioned, a change.org petition with more than 10,000 signatures that was launched 3 weeks ago, pleading with the chancellor to save her job, essentially. There was a sit-in by, I think, 20 to 30 students at the chancellor's office last Friday, I believe, at Vanderbilt, where they sat there for 3 hours letting him know what they wanted him to do, which was to spare her job. And I think in the community at large, there's a lot of sympathy for her. That being said, she is a polarizing figure at Vanderbilt and within the medical center there. Everyone is not her fan.
Where does this go from here? And have you spoken with Beth Ann McLaughlin in recent days or weeks to get a sense of what she might have planned for the future?
Well, she has not been job searching because she really is hoping that, as in her words, that the chancellor will, in quotes, do the right thing. I think that's far from a given. And I think that more than anything else, I suspect Vanderbilt just wants to get this behind them one way or the other. So my hunch is, and it's just a hunch, that there will be some kind of decision on her case, you know, in coming weeks, like sooner rather than later.
This is a story that you've been following, and also you report on sexual harassment and science policy as your beat. When you look at this story, does it strike you as, you know, just a complicated and kind of confusing one-off? Or is this, in your mind, kind of representative of some of the problems within academia and the broader problem of sexual harassment within science?
It's definitely representative. I mean, there are some particularities to her case that are unusual. But the bottom line is, she testified in a sexual harassment investigation and found herself being investigated instead. Incidentally, the university also hired two different law firms at two different points to investigate her. This sends a chilling message to women who want to step up and report on sexual harassment. Whether or not her behavior was entirely exemplary seems to me a bit beside the point. The sort of take-home message for someone watching this from afar is, ooh, you take a lot of risk when you report in a sexual harassment investigation. And so then there's a bigger question about how can these investigations be carried out in a way that really protects the women who are bringing the questions about harassers.
Meredith Wadman is a staff writer for the journal Science. She covers biology research, policy, and sexual harassment. And she's been following the story of Beth Ann McLaughlin of Vanderbilt University and Me Too STEM. Meredith, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Heather.
Up next, using modern technology to reveal modern slavery. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Charges of buying sex brought against Patriots owner Robert Kraft have focused public attention on the problem of sex trafficking. The International Labor Organization estimates that there are nearly 5 million people in forced sexual exploitation around the globe at any time. And that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to modern slavery. The same group estimates that 40 million people are held in forced marriages and forced labor, doing everything from domestic work to mining and fishing. Now, researchers are coming up with novel ways to find them. Doreen Boyd is an associate professor and reader in the School of Geography at the University of Nottingham in the UK, and she leads the data program at the university's Rights Lab. They've been using satellite imagery to uncover possible cases of modern-day slavery. Doreen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Your previous work was using satellite imagery to study ecological problems like, you know, changes in forest cover, deforestation. How did you get involved in work trying to detect slavery?
Absolutely. I've been looking at, you know, land cover change and pollution and what have you, environmental problems in space for about 20 years. And then what we have at the University of Nottingham is the Rights Lab, which is quite a new lab. It was set up about a year and a half ago. And the idea behind it was to bring together scholars from all across the academies, so people with a social science background, a computer science background, a philosophy background, and all coming together to focus on one human rights issue. And the one that we're focusing on at the moment is modern slavery. So just by having that sort of set up where we can all come together to talk about this particular issue means that we're starting to spark ideas off. And one of my colleagues said, oh, I've looked at some brick kilns where we know there's a high prevalence of bonded labour in the brick belt region of South Asia. And I can see them on Google Earth. So what can we do with this information? And that kind of started our 1.5 year programme thus far on trying to identify sites associated with slavery from satellite imagery.
And you've recently published essentially the test case looking for these brick kilns and being able to find them. And in fact, being able to kind of work your way to an estimate of the number of people that might be involved at a certain site. I mean, that seems like an amazing amount of information to be able to get from a picture from space.
I think we kind of underestimate the technology that's going on around us. And we do have these Earth observing satellites that are orbiting the Earth all the time. And they have been for nearly 50 years. They've improved in their, you know, the technology. We can see more things from space with them. And the key thing with the brick kilns was we knew quite a lot of information about certain brick kilns, individual brick kilns on the ground that non-governmental organisations had informed us about, which was there was a high number of bonded labourers being used. We have families that are working for nothing to pay off the bonds that they supposedly have with the brick kiln owners. And so because we know that, and we know generally that there could be, you know, up to about 80 people working in a kiln, and around 80% of them could be working under bonded labour reasons. Well, what we needed to do then was to say, right, well, how many kilns in total are there? And nobody knew that. That wasn't the sort of mapping that governments do or agencies do. So we were able to use the satellite imagery that are collected, that are available to us, to make that estimate.
And how many did you find?
We found around 55,000 of them with, you know, plus or minus 5,000. So that's a lot of brick kilns, yeah.
And that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people, absolutely.
Doreen Boyd, this case of finding brick kilns is kind of the tip of the iceberg. Obviously, there are many different forms that modern slavery takes, including illegal mining, fishing, of course, human trafficking and the sex trade. How many different kinds of slavery do you think you might be able to detect with satellite imagery or for that matter, other satellite data?
Yeah, that's a really good question and one I pondered on for quite a while. I mean, if we take the rule that you need to be able to see where the slavery is happening, i.e. the infrastructure that is associated with slavery, and then we look at the International Labour Organization's estimates of how many slaves are working under different types of slavery. As you mentioned, we have human trafficking, sex trafficking, but then you have bonded labour. And I reckon it's around a third of the total of the, 40 million plus people that are in modern slavery at the moment, we could see from space, and we could provide some more intelligence about that third than we have at the moment. So that's really exciting.
And that's, as you were saying, primarily based on being able to see the infrastructure, right? So being able to actually, I guess, see the mine or see fishermen or some of the fishing processing camps and infrastructure?
Yeah, and even fishing boats. So some of the really early work that had been done, which was the sort of predecessor to the work we've been doing, we've been focusing more on terrestrial slavery, so slavery that happens on land, but there's also a lot of slavery that happens in fishing vessels. And some of the early work has shown that you can count these vessels, you can see these vessels from space. You can see how different vessels are tied up. They never seem to go to shore. And they're the ones that you think, hang on, what's going on here? There must be something not quite legal. So it's that sort of thought process that we've applied to terrestrial modern slavery. So the fish processing camps in the Sundarban Reserve Forest of Bangladesh. Now, these mangrove forests should be absolutely untouched. This is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Yet we know again from the ground, so one of my colleagues in the lab had been to Bangladesh and seen that there are these fish processing camps that are processing the fish that are caught out at sea and then brought into the fringes of the mangrove forest. These forests are cleared and children are used to gut the fish, process them, farm the shrimp and the prawns in the pools. And again, you can see that from space and you can monitor that over time as well.
What you're talking about, though, is a lot of discriminating what should be there, legal and approved and permitted land uses, from what shouldn't be there. And for a human being to do that, who knows the lay of the land, who knows the laws, all of those kinds of things, right? It's possible to look at a picture and say, hey, that's not quite right. Is it possible to teach a computer to do this in an automated way and cross-reference all that data and start in an automated way highlighting, hey, here's something that needs to be looked into?
If we can get the markers right and there are data to support those markers, absolutely, we can feed a machine an algorithm to say, have a look, trawl over the data and tell us where you think something might be happening. So we're collecting satellite imagery all of the time. So you can extract metrics from those imagery. Then, you know, layer that with, as you say, you know, where the permits might be for logging, for example, or mining and so on. And you can just build up the layers and then this become an automated process because, you know, these things move around. And so we need to try and have an automated system that we can, you know, track what's going on and maybe even predict where the next site may be. And if we can do that, that would be really, really powerful.
Doreen Boyd, your efforts and your colleagues' efforts at the Rights Lab at the University of Nottingham are gearing up, but you are not the only ones working in this space trying to use satellite data to detect slavery. And there was a recent conference in New York about this. What are some of the questions and the efforts kind of at the leading edge of this field right now?
It's the last sort of 10 miles, as they say. You know, we can collect all of this data, but what do we do with it? How do we verify it? How do we make sure that we use it in the best way to ensure that, you know, in the long run, that we are abolishing modern slavery and making sure it doesn't happen again? And, you know, satellite imaging is not the only technique that can be used. So people have looked at, obviously, the dark web, bitcoins, those sorts of things to try and, again, sort of get an indicator of what might be or where something might be happening that is linked to slavery or is, in fact, modern slavery.
Of course, detecting those instances where, hey, this looks odd or that shouldn't be there, I wonder if that's modern slavery. that then needs to be followed up on the ground with some sort of investigation and enforcement. Is the infrastructure there to do that? And are you finding receptive audiences for your analyses?
Absolutely. So this is very much what we're focusing on now with the brick kilns work. So we have the mapping, and obviously we want that mapping to be used, but we need to, you know, approach that with due diligence and with ethics in mind. So we have partners, NGOs, non-governmental organisations that have been working in these areas, for instance, in India, Pakistan and Nepal, for a long time. So they know the sensitivities on the ground. They have various interventions that they're trying to deploy. This is, we hope, another layer of intelligence and information for them and evidence that allows them to do their job a little bit easier.
I want to come full circle. I mean, your prior work had to do with environmental issues. And obviously, when you see a fishing camp or a brick kiln in the middle of what should be a UNESCO-protected forest, that's both a human rights issue and an environmental issue. These two things are very connected, aren't they?
Absolutely. And this is something that we really are trying to push now in terms of thinking about policy, thinking about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, of which there are 17. Let's not look at them each in isolation. Let's see where these connections are. Let's develop intervention policies and approaches and education around linking those SDGs where we can, and then making things much more efficient, much more robust. And if we can, you know, abolish modern slavery, that has environmental repercussions as well in terms of, you know, we improve our interactions with the environment. But also, you know, flipping that over, people tend to move into instances of modern slavery, or they can do, because of an environmental issue. For instance, flooding, climate change, wildfires and so on may move people on from their particular locality, their particular occupations. Where do they go? They may end up in an instance where they are trafficked, or in terms of the brick kilns, may end up working in urban areas where there are lots of kilns. So we need to think about modern slavery, not in isolation, but definitely linked to other SDGs. And the one that we are focusing on very much so in the Rights Lab is the link to environmental change.
Well, that's Doreen Boyd of the Rights Lab at the University of Nottingham in the UK, where they're pioneering the use of satellite data to uncover cases of modern slavery. Doreen, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed that.
Coming up, we explore the frontiers of high-tech art. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Technological advances have always influenced art. Think synthetic dyes or the invention of photography. Now artists are diving into the realms of nanotech, genetics, and artificial intelligence. And MIT, a leading research institution, is leading the way in the synergy between art and science. Leela Kinney is Executive Director of Arts Initiatives and the Center for Art, Science, and Technology at MIT. Leela, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Leela, MIT recently hosted a workshop on frontiers in science, technology, and the arts. And one of the things that workshop kind of focused on was new materials and the way those are being used and built upon by artists. Can you give us some examples?
I'd love to. Yes, it was actually a symposium, and it was in conjunction with this launch, both of the new Nano building last fall, which is the largest facility of its kind in the country to work on nanotechnology, and also of the new Stephen A. Schwarzman College of Computing. So let me tell you about one very interesting thing that was presented in the panel on existing collaborations. So this was a collaboration that recently took place among MIT, Microsoft, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It was a hackathon where the Metropolitan Museum made its digital collection, the API of its digital collection, available to explore and a desire to sort of discover how these online collections could be made more more accessible and used for interesting new developments in learning, perhaps. So one of our distinguished visiting artists, Matthew Ritchie, who's kind of well-known in Boston circles, anyway, he and a graduate student in CSAIL, the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, did a project where they took the Met's collection and used GAN, a generative adversarial network, to explore relationships between different objects in the Met's collection that would allow users to understand the sort of space between objects, their similar features, and generate new objects, which is why it was called the Generist Studio. And that, I think, that kind of exploration, which will ultimately become more user-friendly, of a museum's entire digital collection has very exciting possibilities.
So, again, what does that actually mean?
It takes trained neural networks, that's what they're called, and you run a lot of information or imagery through them. It looks for features, you know, features that are similar or different, and it produces something that's in between the two. It's actually two different networks pitting one against the other. That's why it's adversarial. That's why it's called adversarial. It's a little bit maybe confusing, that particular term. But everybody is very excited about this because they can learn to mimic, you know, any sort of big data set, right? But then you put one in relation to the other. And so people think that this is, you know, like the way the brain makes connections, the way you and I, because we're humans, are really good at idioms and metaphors and things like this. This is perhaps one of the ways to make machine learning not be just rote and repetitive and sort of, you know how people are so afraid of AI just embedding our prejudices in code or something. So this is something that's different from each of the huge data sets that are put in relation to one another.
How does that actually manifest itself for, I guess, users, not even viewers, right? You're actually saying, okay, start with this object, now show me similar things. How does that work as an experience?
What they did was they took, they made a sort of projected map of the Met's collection. So like, let's say we're going from the Middle Eastern, let's take some three-dimensional objects, say pots or so forth. So let's go from Greek to Middle Eastern to Cypriot or so forth. And the GAN selects identical or similar features, and the visitors can explore by manipulating themselves the map, and they can then see new images that are generated from the similar features of those Met image.
Leela Kinney, we were talking about this workshop on or symposium on frontiers in science, technology, and the arts, where computing, like you've been talking about, was one of the main focus areas. And then the other one was new materials. It was in part, the symposium was in collaboration with MIT's new nanotechnology center. How is nanotech getting involved in art, or how is art getting involved in nanotech?
Well, that is to be seen. We're going to develop, we hope, a series of residencies and explorations of the new nano facilities once they're really fully up and learning. But the interesting thing about nanotechnology, of course, is it's making two things. One is it's making visible things we could never otherwise see. And the second is that it's able to manipulate materials on this subatomic scale so that you create all kinds of new properties and characteristics. So I'll give you one example of an artwork that was created, again, by one of our visiting artists here at MIT, working in collaboration with faculty and colleagues here, and it was called Sandcastle, where the artist Vic Muniz came in and worked with Marcelo Coelho, who was then a graduate student in the Media Lab and is now a lecturer in the Department of Architecture and an interaction designer. They took a drawing of a sandcastle that Vic Muniz had done, and they etched it on a grain of sand using an electron microscope. Then they re-photographed it and blew it up. So it was a kind of perfect melding of the imagery, the sandcastle, and the actual material that it sort of inspired, if you will, the drawing to create a kind of new work of art that in and of itself showed this amazing kind of ladder of scales. There's another example that I might give you that involves spider webs.
I think I've heard about this project. Yeah, a larger-than-life 3D spider web and potentially something about sounds and vibration involved.
You're absolutely right. And it's an installation in the Nano building and what they call their immersion lab right now. And it's also a live performance. But actually, it goes back to 2012 and the Berlin-based artist Tomas Saraceno, who was our inaugural visiting artist with CAST and has had a range of collaborations here. Among the most important was with Marcus Bühler, the head of civil and environmental engineering, who had himself worked on spider webs for some time. Of course, civil engineers are so interested in them because, you know, they're amazing structures, you know, kind of 3D structures without scaffolding in space. The actual protein in the spider silk has amazing tensile strength as well as elasticity. So wouldn't it make a great artificial building material? So Marcus had worked on that forever. And Tomas had done large-scale installations based on the morphology of spider webs. I first saw one at the Venice Biennale in 2009 called, I think, 12 Billions. Why was he interested in that? Because when physicists and cosmologists talk about the origin of the universe, they often use the metaphor of a spider's web for what it might have looked like just after the Big Bang. So he was very interested in this. And no one had ever tried to map or make a model of a three-dimensional spider web. Yeah, two-dimensional orb webs, sure, but not a three-dimensional one. So he developed this amazing scanning technique. He actually got some black widow spiders into his studio.
Yikes.
I know, but Tomas loves spiders, and he's actually made me get over my fears of them. His whole studio has a whole floor, you know, where there's a spider keeper there because he works with these amazing co-workers, he would call them, who make these beautiful sculptures and installations based on this. Anyway, with some technical people and arachnologists at a university at Darmstadt, he developed this scanning technique. So he comes to MIT. He shows these scans to Marcus Bühler, who gets very excited about him. Marcus had meanwhile been developing a mathematical model of spider webs in order to understand the stress points and, you know, how they held together. Because, you know, when you stick your finger in a spider web, even a simple orb web, the whole thing doesn't fall apart. It's an amazing architectural, you know, construction. So anyway, they started working together, and they developed a new scanning technique, a new mathematical model, and then Marcus and his research team developed a way to sonify it. There's a couple of scientific papers on this, one on the scanning technique, one on the actual sonification technique coming out soon. Marcus talked about this in that symposium. But then Evan Zaporin, who is the faculty director of CAST and a composer, worked with several collaborators, and they did a live performance installation based on that mathematical model of the web. So they actually performed inside a cube which had projections of the mathematical model of the web on the outside. And as the graduate student and researcher in Marcus's lab, Isabel Sue, manipulated the actual mathematical model, both Evan and his collaborator Christine Southwark would improvise with those sounds while Ian Hatwick was sort of doing a live sound mix of the whole thing. It's quite extraordinary. And the installation now in the Nano building is a kind of sonic landscape of that. It can be both performed live and as an installation that has the projections and the sounds of the sonified web. We call it an interspecies collaboration.
Leela Kinney is Executive Director of Arts Initiatives and the Center for Art, Science, and Technology at MIT. Thanks for a little tour of the frontiers of art and science at MIT. Thanks so much for talking with us, Leela.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. We're already thinking about Pi Day coming up on Thursday. I'll be starting the day with a nice 5K, otherwise known as 3.14 miles, before moving on to the really fun pie. Let us know how you celebrate. Share your photos of pies, 5Ks, and pie-inspired arts and activities on Facebook or Twitter. We're Living Lab Radio. Happy Pie Day, everybody. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.